I would like to take you on a journey across the water to the land of my fathers. It's a land of rocky mountains where the purple heather blooms on craggy slopes, a land of lochs and misty glens where heroes like William Wallace and Rob Roy MacGregor sought refuge and cover from the redcoats. It's a land of castles, towering edifices with many a ghostly secret lurking behind their massive walls. A land of clans and tartans, an ancient land of people steeped in the Celtic tradition. A land of mystery. Scotland, a wee country with a big impact on the world. Did you know that the whole of Scotland, the whole of England, the whole of Ireland and Wales all together would fit into Texas about 2.5 times? So Scotland is really quite a tiny country compared to somewhere like the US. And yet, her influence on the world has been quite great. There's a fascinating book called The 100, a ranking of the most influential persons in history by Michael M. Hart. It details people who, since the beginning of history, have had an influence on our world. The author says, it is interesting to note that no fewer than 5 of the 100 came from Scotland. All 5, in fact, are in the top half of the list. Since the Scots constitute only about 1/8 of 1% of the world's population, this represents a truly astonishing concentration of talent and achievement. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the people from Scotland who have made an impact on our world. First, let's go to the land of Cossacks, Swan Lake, and onion-shaped roofs, Russia. Samuel Gregg was born in Inverkeithing, Scotland, in 1735. The court of Russia had requested the government of Great Britain to send out some British naval officers to help improve their navy. Lieutenant Gregg had the honour of being selected as one. His superior abilities soon attracted the notice of the Russian government, and he was speedily promoted to the rank of captain. During a particularly severe battle with the Turkish fleet, Captain Gregg, with his own hand, set fire to the enemy ships, then leaped overboard and, under oppressive fire from the Turks, swam back to his own boat. For this and the following day's successful bombardment of a Turkish city, he was immediately promoted by Count Orlo to admiral. He became known as the father of the Russian Navy. At age 53, Sir Samuel became ill, and this man obviously meant a great deal to Catherine the Great, as she sent her personal physician to attend him. Unfortunately, to no avail, as he died 3 months later. The Tsarina gave him an elaborate state funeral and ordered a gold medal to be struck in his honour. Would it be presumptuous of me to assume that you already know who asked this immortal question? Dr. Livingstone, I presume. Well, David Livingstone, born in Blantyre, Scotland, in 1813, became a missionary and went to Africa. He was the first white man to witness Victoria Falls and named them after his queen. But he had been missing for 3 years in the deepest jungles of Africa, and this caused quite a stir out in the Western world. So much so that American journalist Henry Stanley of the New York Herald was ordered to find Livingstone. Now, this was back at a time when Africa was known as the Dark Continent, and so Stanley set out on a 15-month expedition to find the elusive, possibly dead, missionary. When he reached Africa, he hired a small army of porters, guides, hunters, and armed escorts, along with pack animals, because it was very dangerous over there back then. And in November 1871, missionary explorer David Livingstone was finally located by Henry Stanley beside Lake Tanganyika in Africa. Now we'll head down under to New Zealand. Robert Stout was born in Lerwick, way up in the Shetland Islands, which are the furthest north reaches of Scotland. They're separated from the north of Scotland by first the Pentland Firth, then the Orkney Islands. At the age of 13, Robert had acquired such a sound grounding in his education that he was appointed a pupil teacher. At 18, he completed his apprenticeship and soon after decided to leave and head to New Zealand, where he eventually became Prime Minister of that beautiful country. We'll go now to the land of the lotus blossom. Thomas Glover, born in 1838 in Fraserburgh, Scotland, became known to the Japanese as the Scottish Samurai. He initiated the organizing of the vast Mitsubishi Empire. His home in Nagasaki has been turned into a temple like Graceland's, but so far, no one has seen Elvis Presley there. He arrived in Japan in 1859 at the age of 21 and spent the rest of his life there. He married a Japanese woman with whom he had two children and made extensive studies of Japanese life, customs, flora and fauna, and was eventually honored by the Japanese government for his contribution to the development of Japan. It was he who brought the first steam train to Japan and who founded the shipyard, which was the forerunner of the great Mitsubishi Yard, which dominates the harbor today, and was the main reason that Nagasaki was hit by an atomic bomb. Et maintenant, nous traversons la Manche pour visiter France. And now we cross over the English Channel to visit France. The writer and philosopher Voltaire. Now, I'm not going to tell you he was from Scotland. No, he wasn't. He was from France. But he was referred to as the Enlightenment's brightest light. And he said, "We look to Scotland for all our ideas of civilization." Mind you, I don't think he'd ever seen a Scottish football match, that's a soccer game, or visited an Edinburgh pub when he said that. There's one Scot who has influenced just about the whole world with his works. He was born in 1759 and died in 1796. So he only lived for 37 years, but he was very prolific. Robert Burns has had a lasting worldwide influence. He's Scotland's most famous immortal bard. Immortal because he's dead. His works have been translated into more than 40 languages. And I recently met a young man from Russia who told me he studied Burns in his native Russian. Every year, his birthday is celebrated in every major city throughout the world, including Dallas, and even Tyler. Here's one of his poems. It's called To a Mouse, and it's where the famous line, "The best laid plans of mice and men," comes from. But as you'll hear, it's a wee bit different in the original form. We sleekit, cowering timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start a war sae hasty, wi' bicker and brattle. I would be laith to run and chase thee wi' murder and pattle. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal. I doubt na whiles but thou may thieve. What then? Poor beastie, thou maun live. A daemon icker in a thrave's a sma' request. I'll get a blessing with a lave and ne'er miss it. Thy wee bit hoosie, too, in ruin. It's silly was, the winds are strewin', and naething now to big a newin, o' foggage green, and bleak December winds ensuin, baith snell and keen. Thou saw the fields laid bare and waste, and weary winter coming fast, and cosy here beneath the blast thou thought to dwell, till crash, the cruel coulter passed out through thy cell. That wee bit heap o' leaves and stibble has cost thee mony a weary nibble. Now thou's turned out for all thy trouble, but house or hauled to thaw the winter's sleety dribble and cranreuch cauld. But, Moosey, thou art no thy lane, in proving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes o' mice and men gang after glay, and lay a snout but grief and pain for promised joy. Still, thou art blessed compared with me. The present only toucheth thee. But och, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward, though I canny see, I guess and fear. Living in Scotland, especially back in the last century, was always a struggle, and people had to get by on practically nothing. And they did. And I think because of that spirit, Scotland has produced so many very determined, powerful and influential people. The weather is quite harsh, cold, wet and windy most of the time. And I'm secretly glad it's like this, because you see, it helps to keep Scotland pure. Here's a wee story which will illustrate what I'm talking about. A few years ago, my brother-in-law very kindly rented a 40-foot boat for my sister, himself, my brother, nephew, my son and me. We wanted to look for Nessie, the Loch Ness monster, and Alexander, my son, was quite excited about this. We picked up the boat in Fort William, and after just a few minutes' tuition, we were let loose to take this big boat anywhere we wanted. Well, of course, it started raining at the outset, and since none of us had any experience driving something like this, I was volunteered to do so. It was quite scary trying to manoeuvre something that size, because unlike a car, when you turn the wheel, it doesn't respond immediately. It's a gradual sort of thing. Anyway, the second day we were out on Loch Ness, the mountains plummeting right down to the water's edge, just like fjords, except the loch is much wider. It was so beautiful with the sun shining. As far as the eye could see, there was only one other boat on the loch. This is a huge loch too. My sister, who's been all over the world, said that had we been on the Norfolk Broads in England, or in France somewhere, or anywhere else in Europe, the place would have been mobbed with tourists. But we had this incredible scenic grandeur all to ourselves. So you see, I'm kind of glad the weather's so bad most of the time. Otherwise, Scotland would be inundated with tourists. And I'm sure the question you're all asking is, did we find Nessie? Well, no, we didn't find any signs of Nessie. But on a previous trip, when Alexander and his mother and I went, well, we weren't on a boat that time, we walked down to the water's edge, right by what's called Urquhart Castle, an old ruin of a castle. And as we got down to the water's edge, we heard this big splash. And we couldn't see, because there were some trees around there, exactly where it came from. But the funny thing is, this splash was too big for a fish, and we didn't see anything there, nothing. So, you never know, that could have been Nessie. What do you think? And now, the envelope, please. Here are the five who made it to the 100, a ranking of the most influential persons in history. At number 22, James Watt. Now his steam engine, although not the first to be developed, was the first practical device for converting steam into useful work. So this man was extremely instrumental in helping bringing about the Industrial Revolution. At number 24 is James Clerk Maxwell. Now, as an aside, I just want to let you know that George Washington was ranked number 26. So he's in good company there. James Clerk Maxwell was a physicist who formulated four sets of equations that express the basic laws of electricity and magnetism. At number 30, we have Adam Smith. He wrote a very famous volume called The Wealth of Nations back in 1776. And Adam Smith laid the intellectual framework that explained the free market and which still holds true today. Every time your telephone rings, or chirps, or plays you a wee tune, do you know that you have a Scotsman to thank for that? He tutored Helen Keller, and she dedicated her autobiography to him. He was also the second president of National Geographic, back when it was a scientific journal, and he was also from Edinburgh. Did anybody see his house when he visited Edinburgh? It's in Charlotte Square. That was, of course, Alexander Graham Bell. At number 43, we have Alexander Fleming, a spore that drifted into his lab and took root on a culture dish, started a chain of events that altered forever the treatment of bacterial infections. When it was finally recognized for what it was, the most efficacious life-saving drug in the world, penicillin, would alter forever the treatment of bacterial infection. By the middle of the century, Fleming's discovery had spawned a huge pharmaceutical industry, churning out synthetic penicillins that would conquer some of mankind's most ancient scourges, including syphilis, gangrene, and tuberculosis. Now, this next person didn't make the 100, but he, like Alexander Fleming, made a great contribution to medicine. Sir James Young Simpson, born in 1811 in Bathgate and the son of a baker, James attended Edinburgh University at the tender age of only 14. In 1847, as chair of the midwifery department, he tested chloroform, which was much less potent than the ether which had previously been used for anaesthetics. So he made surgery a much less painful proposition. A lot of people over here talk about Carnegie Hall, but in Scotland, for some reason, we always put the accent on the second syllable, so we refer to it as Carnegie Hall. And Andrew Carnegie, born in 1835 in Dunfermline, Scotland, moved to America with his parents and became a stoker in a textile factory at age 13, then a telegraph messenger, and by 17 was making the princely sum of $35 a month as assistant to a superintendent on the Pennsylvania Railroad. And I have to tell you that at 15, I made the princely sum of $28 per month. But he went on to become the richest man in the world, making his fortune in the steel industry. He retired in 1901, giving away $350 million, an unthinkable sum back then, and worth $3 billion in 1996 dollars. Today, his charitable donations are earning an unbelievable $8 every single second from the funds he established. Now, having mentioned how we differ a little in pronunciation of our words, I'd like to talk a little bit about our language. Although in general we speak English in Scotland, we have our very own Scots language, and we even have a Scots dictionary. Now, this is not Gaelic. Gaelic is something totally different, a completely different language. And the Gaelic language is spoken by around 86,000 individuals, primarily in the north of Scotland and in the Western Isles. For example, Skye, Lewis and Harris. The Scots language is very similar to the English because at one time they were both essentially the same. However, back in the 12th century, English speakers gradually modified their way of pronouncing the A sound to an O sound. Words like stain and gay, which we use in Scotland, meaning stone and go, originally had the same pronunciation in Scots and English. Bit by bit, the English changed and is now quite different from the Scots. In English, one might say, I don't know the little boy over there who threw the stone at me. In Scots, we'd say, I dinna ken the wee laddie over there that flung the stane at me. The Scots language is quite apparent in all of Robert Burns's poems, and he strove to keep the language alive. But the aristocracy in Scotland frowned upon this uncouth and vulgar language, which was unsuitable for people who wished to be thought of as polite. So even today, when you speak with someone educated at an expensive school in Scotland, they'll really sound as if they're English to you. Sir Harry Lauder was one who spoke the true Scots language. During his peak, he was the highest paid music hall artist in the world. Like so many Scots who made it, he was born poor and worked in the coal mines. He loved to sing and had a wicked sense of humour, and he started to make a name for himself on the music hall circuit. He was different from most comedians because he would sing love songs. In 1905, he had a big success with I Love a Lassie. Harry Lauder sang a song which featured some very Scottish words, and I'd like to teach you some of them. The first word is braw, B-R-A-W, which means lovely, brilliant, fantastic. The next one is bricht. That means bright, as in bright, light. Moonlicht, as in moonlight. Nicht means night. The nicht, tonight. And it's in this little song that goes like this. Just a wee dochen, Doris. Just a wee drap, that's all. Just a wee dochen, Doris, afore you gang a war. There's a wee wifey waiting in a wee butt in Ben. If you can say it's a brabricht moonlicht nicht, you're all right, you can. Deacon Brodie was a deacon in the church and a pillar of Edinburgh society. During the day, he was this upstanding man of the cloth. But what people didn't know was that in the evenings, he led a life of debauchery, visiting, drinking, gambling dens, and the most hellish houses of ill repute. He made wax keys of the wealthy homes he visited during the day and would rob his wealthy neighbours in the evenings. It is ironic that Brodie himself had designed the mechanism and bought the timber for the new gallows at the Tolbooth, which was to be the instrument of his death. But mystery surrounds his death, as when his grave was opened after some speculation, no body was found. This all caused quite a scandal in Edinburgh, but it gave a famous Scottish author, Robert Louis Stevenson, the idea for a story that everyone today knows as the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Robert Louis Stevenson was also born in Edinburgh. But I tell you, lots of famous people were born in Edinburgh. He also wrote Treasure Island and Kidnapped, The Master of Ballantrae, and A Child's Garden of Verses. I'm sure just about everyone has heard of Encyclopedia Britannica. Back in Scotland, people used to sell it door to door. I remember them coming around, and I've seen many houses with large bookcases filled with these beautiful leather-bound volumes. Did they come by and sell door-to-door over here? Well, you could pay it up a month at a time. I remember it cost a lot of money, and my family could never have afforded it. Well, I know you're going to get bored hearing about Edinburgh, but Mr. Colin McFarquhar in Edinburgh, back in 1768, conceived, printed and published the very first Encyclopedia Britannica. Imagine, if you will, that you're a person living in the 18th century, and suddenly you find yourself in the living room of an American family back in the 60s. What do you think would be the most unfathomable thing you might see? Well, I think it would be these people who were staring passively at this strange box in the corner, all of them apparently hypnotized by it. And unlike in the 18th century, there probably would be no lively conversation going on and no music being played, at least by the occupants anyway. Our time traveler would be at a complete loss as to what was happening, until we told him that a certain Scotsman named John Logie Baird, who was born in Helensburgh, developed the first ever television that went into widespread use. Now, I hope you're all taking notes and will attempt to corroborate all these facts I'm giving you, as by now I'm sure you're all thinking that all these things couldn't have been invented by Scots. Now, here's something for all you brainy mathematical types. Did any of you ever use logs at school? And I don't mean to throw in the fire and keep teacher warm. I mean the kind, well, just what in the heck are logarithms? I thought that maybe they were African in origin. You know, log rhythms, maybe jungle drummers? No? Well, actually, I looked it up on a website that was supposed to explain in simple terms how logarithms work. But I still couldn't quite understand it. I think my math days are over. Anyway, what has logarithms got to do with Scotland, you may ask? I'm sure you have a wee inkling though, don't you? John Napier, born in 1550 in Edinburgh, invented, compiled, and published logarithms. He also invented the decimal point and the whole concept of decimal numbers. So that definitely made quite a difference in our world, don't you think? It's funny though, a Scotsman inventing the decimal point, and we didn't go decimal until 1970. Before that, we had pounds, shillings, and pence. If I was to mention a lost voice, and then mention Wendy in the next breath, what famous character would come to mind? Peter Pan. Well, you have a Scotsman to thank for creating Never Never Land, Tinkerbell, and the boy that wouldn't grow up. Sir James Barrie, born in 1860 in Kirriemuir, Angus, Scotland, wrote Peter Pan. He also wrote The Admiral Crichton, and in 1922 he was given the rectorship of St. Andrews University, to whom he delivered a moving address on courage. And in the same year, he received the chancellorship of Edinburgh University. Now later on this summer, the actor Johnny Depp will be portraying James Barrie in a new movie about Peter Pan. His first name was Thomas. He was born, he was born in Edinburgh in 1930. His crib was the bottom drawer of a wardrobe. He started work delivering milk on a horse and cart, and later became a French polisher, polishing coffins. He worked as a bouncer at the local dance hall, the Palais de Danse, and he became known there as Big Tam, because he was into bodybuilding and he was pretty big. Then in 1953, he went down to London and represented Scotland in the Mr. Universe competition. But luckily for us, he came in third. So while he was there, he auditioned for South Pacific and got a part in the chorus. This got him interested in acting, and I'll give you a wee clue now. His family originally came from Ireland and first settled in Glasgow. And then he took his grandfather's name of Sean and went on to become the most famous James Bond ever. At the incredible age of 69, he was voted the century's sexiest man. Of course, we're talking about Sean Connery. Elementary. Just this one word should be enough, I believe, to hint at our next Scottish author. Can anyone guess with just that one word, elementary? Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the quintessential English detective Sherlock Holmes, and let's not forget his very important sidekick, Dr. Watson. Conan Doyle wrote 56 stories and 4 novels featuring the pipe-smoking super sleuth with the unmistakable deerstalker hat. And he was born in Edinburgh in 1859. He also wrote the fascinating tale of the Lost World, which was made into a film in 1925. It's the story of a famous zoologist who leads a scientific expedition into the hills of northern Mongolia in search of the Lost World. Once they find their way in though, there's no way out, and they meet dinosaurs trapped in this world frozen in time. Sir Walter Scott, another famous Scottish author, born in 1771 in, you guessed it, Edinburgh, he wrote the Waverley novels, also Ivanhoe and Rob Roy, and the lyrics to Hail to the Chief. He also wrote the poem Lady of the Lake and Marmion, which features the line, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." I'll now read you another of his poems, Lochinvar. O young Lochinvar has come out of the west. Through all the wide border, his steed was the best. And save his good broadsword, he weapons had none. He rode all unarmed, and he rode all alone. So faithful in love, and so dauntless in war, there never was knight like the young Lochinvar. He stayed not for brake, and he stopped not for stone. He swam the Esk River, where ford there was none. But ere he alighted at Netherby Gate, the bride had consented, the gallant came late. For a laggard in love and a dastard in war was to wed the fair Ellen of brave Lochinvar. So boldly he entered the Netherby Hall, among bridesmen and kinsmen and brothers and all. Then spoke the bride's father, his hand on his sword, for the poor craven bridegroom said never a word. Oh, come ye in peace here, or come ye in war, or to dance at our bridal, young Lord Lochinvar? I long wooed your daughter, my suit ye denied. Love swells like the Solway, but ebbs like its tide. And now I am come with this lost love of mine, to lead but one measure, drink one cup of wine. There are maidens in Scotland more lovely by far, that would gladly be bride to the young Lochinvar. The bride kissed the goblet, the knight took it up, he quaffed off the wine, and he threw down the cup. She looked down to blush, and she looked up to sigh, with a smile on her lips and a tear in her eye. He took her soft hand ere her mother could bar. Now tread we a measure, said young Lochinvar, so stately his form and so lovely her face, that never a hall such a galliard did grace. While her mother did fret and her father did fume, and the bridegroom stood dangling his bonnet and plume, and the bride maidens whispered, 'Twere better by far to have matched our fair cousin with young Lochinvar. One touch to her hand and one word in her ear, when he reached the hall door and the charger stood near, so light to the croup the fair lady he swung, so light to the saddle before her he sprung. 'She is won! We're gone over bank, bush and score. They'll have fleet steeds that follow,' quoth young Lochinvar. There was mounting among Grahams of the Netherby clan, Forsters, Fenwicks and Musgraves. They rode and they ran. There was racing and chasing on Cannobie Lee, but the lost bride of Netherby ne'er did they see. So daring in love and so dauntless in war, have ye e'er heard of gallant like young Lochinvar? Back in 1924, Eric Liddell was aiming for the 100 metres at the Paris Olympics. But when he learned that it would be run on a Sunday, to him, a very sacred day, he switched to the much further and more demanding 200 metres and the 400 metres. Incredibly, he finished third in the 200 metre sprint, taking an unexpected bronze medal. He quietly made his way through the heats for the 400 metres, but was not expected to win. Arms thrashing, head bobbing, legs dancing, Liddell ran to victory, 5 metres ahead of the silver medalist. The Flying Scotsman had a gold medal and a world record. But instead of basking in the glory and the assured fame and fortune that would have been his had he stayed in the UK, he went to China and became a missionary. He spent trying times in China, getting about on foot and bicycle on some very rough roads to spread his deep and unshakable faith. He even made an extremely dangerous journey to save 2 wounded men, both left for dead, by going into Japanese-occupied territory. Later, however, he was captured by the Japanese and eventually died of a brain tumour in a Japanese internment camp in China. A movie was made about his incredible feat, and I'm sure you've probably seen Chariots of Fire. We stay in the land of 1,000 bicycles. Did any of you see the movie The Last Emperor? It was a true story of Pu Yi, the last emperor of China. The film was actually shot in the Forbidden City in Beijing and was the first movie ever to be shot there. I went to China and visited the Forbidden City, and it's an amazing place. Gold-tiled roofs, 9,999 rooms, because only heaven can have 10,000. Delicately crafted handrails of marble and dragons sweeping up the stairways. Nothing can prepare you for the size of this imperial palace. One huge square leads into another, and another, and yet another, with endless treasures hidden behind its foreboding walls. The emperor had 2,000 concubines, for back in these ancient times, there was no television, and an emperor needed distractions. Do you remember the character which Peter O'Toole played? He was the tutor to Pu Yi, the young emperor, and he was there primarily to teach him English. And he looked so incongruous there among all these Chinese people dressed in their traditional clothing. And he, in his top hat and bow tie, standing so tall and straight. In fact, Pu Yi used to say that this man was wearing an iron corset because he stood so straight. Edinburgh figures yet again in this story because Sir Reginald Johnson, in real life, was tutor to the last emperor. Can you guess where he was born? Yes, he was born in Edinburgh and became fluent in three Chinese dialects. When I visited China, I met a really beautiful girl there named Wang Tongtong, who spoke some English. So I decided to learn Chinese. Gosh, it's impossible, totally impossible for someone like me. So I have nothing but supreme admiration for this man who was fluent in three different Chinese dialects. The Emperor Pu Yi bestowed upon him the title of Mandarin. So we have an Edinburgh Mandarin. I think that might be an orange, actually. And the emperor also gave him a sizable piece of land. Queen Victoria and her husband Albert both loved Scotland, and they built Balmoral Castle there. On her first visit to Braemar back in 1848, she attended the Highland Games, which took place there. She must have really enjoyed them, as she became a patron of the games and popularized the present-day games, so much so that there is at least one event every weekend of the year here in the United States. Most people have this picture of Victoria as a very dour person who never seemed to have a smile on her face. And I did too, until I read Queen Victoria's Highland Journal, where she writes so enthusiastically and lovingly about Scotland. She describes in amazing detail her trips into the beautiful areas around Balmoral, taking time to name all the Gaelic names and even mention the names of her servants. And remember, most of the time it was pouring rain and they were travelling on horseback. Yet still, she waxed eloquently about the mountains and glens of her beloved Scotland. Does anyone know what significant part Scotland played in the Declaration of Independence? James Wilson and John Witherspoon, two signatories, were Scots. But actually, we had our very own declaration, signed on April the 6th, 1320, the Declaration of Scottish Independence. I think that the following lines from the declaration hold significance even for Americans. For so long as there shall but 100 of us remain alive, we will never subject ourselves to the dominion of the English. For it is not glory, it is not riches, neither is it honour, but it is liberty alone that we fight and contend for, which no honest man shall lose but with his life. This declaration was signed 6 years after the Battle of Bannockburn. And this is why Tartan Day is celebrated throughout America on April the 6th. I'm sure with the popularity of the movie Braveheart, most people have now heard of William Wallace. He was the first man to unite the clans against King Edward, and the battle that was about to be fought at the end of the movie, known as the Battle of Bannockburn, was won by King Robert the Bruce. Robert Burns wrote the following poem about Wallace and King Robert the Bruce. It's entitled Scots Wha Hae, and this means Scots who have. Scots Wha Hae, where Wallace bled, Scots Wham Bruce has often led, welcome to your gory bed, or to victory. Now's the day, and now's the hour. See the front, O battle lower, see approach proud Edward's power, chains and slavery. Wha will be a traitor knave? Wha will fill a coward's grave? Wha so base as be a slave? Let him turn and flee. Wha for Scotland's king and law? Freedom's sword will strongly draw. Free man stand, or free man fall. Let him follow me. By oppression's woes and pains, by your sons in servile chains, we will drain our dearest veins, but they shall be free. Lay the proud usurpers low, tyrants fall in every foe, liberties in every blow. Let us do or die. Because the weather's so cool in Scotland, we drink a lot of hot tea. In fact, we used to always drink tea with our meals. Tea and toast in the morning, a hot cuppa with lunch, and even with dinner. How many of you drink tea, either hot or cold? Well, I'll wager that a Scotsman is in many of your teacups. Sir Thomas Lipton, born in Glasgow, a young lad of 14, stowed away on a ship bound for the United States. He had only $8 in his pocket. When he arrived in America, he earned a living as a farm labourer in Virginia and South Carolina, and later became a grocery clerk in New York. In 1870, Thomas returned to Glasgow, and 4 years later, opened his own grocery store. By the time he was 30, Thomas Lipton ran a chain of stores, moved his headquarters to London, and became a millionaire. He demonstrated a keen sense of advertising and marketing that would help him live up to his ambition to put a Lipton shop in every Scottish city and beyond. Lipton went on to become a household name through innovation in the tea business, and Queen Victoria knighted him for his commercial success as well as his philanthropy. Having talked a little bit about tea, I think now would be a good time to introduce this tea towel. An Englishman enjoys his breakfast of toast and marmalade, which was invented by Mrs. Keeler of Dundee, Scotland. He reaches for his raincoat, patented by Charles Mackintosh. And in Scotland, we refer to our raincoats as Macs. Mackintosh was from Glasgow, Scotland. This man then dashes to the station on his bicycle, invented by Kirkpatrick Macmillan, blacksmith of Dumfries. The tyres on his bicycle were invented by John Boy Dunlop of Dreghorn, Scotland, and they run on a tarmac road by John McAdam of Ayr, Scotland. The journey by train, whose steam engine was invented by James Watt of Greenock, Scotland, takes him to work at the Bank of England, founded by William Paterson of Dumfries, while opening his mail with adhesive stamps, invented by James Chalmers of Dundee, he puffs on a cigarette, first manufactured by Robert Gloag of Perth. He later rings his wife on the telephone, invented of course by Alexander Graham Bell, born in Edinburgh. She tells him his dinner will be his favourite traditional roast beef from Aberdeen Angus, raised in Aberdeenshire, Scotland. He arrives home to find his daughter watching television, invented by John Logie Baird of Helensburgh, a programme on the US Navy, founded by John Paul Jones of Kirkbeam, Scotland. And his son is reading Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson from Edinburgh. And on lifting the Bible, he finds the very first name mentioned is again a Scot, King James VI, who authorised its translation. The Englishman is unable to turn from the ingenuity of the Scots. He could turn to whiskey, but Scotland supplies the best. Or, to end it all, he might put his head in a gas oven. But coal gas was discovered by William Murdoch of Ayr, Scotland. He could shoot himself, but his breech-loading rifle was invented by Captain Pat Ferguson of Pitfours, Scotland. If unsuccessful, he could be injected with penicillin, discovered by Alexander Fleming, or given an anaesthetic, discovered by Sir James Young Simpson of Bathgate. His last hope, a transfusion of Scots blood. Then he could ask, "Who is like us? Damn few." And they're all dead.